Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on an ultrasound drug delivery technique being developed at MIT. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. The nation is battling an obesity epidemic, and it's hitting our children especially hard. Turns out, the very thing perceived to be one of the causes, the sedentary pastime of sitting in front of a screen playing video games, could provide a great solution. The folks at Hope Labs have cooked up another video game aimed at improving kids' health. They're the same folks who created Remission, a video game designed for kids with cancer to attack their cancer. Studies prove that gaming has made a huge difference in kids' attitude and sense of empowerment. Now comes Zamzi, a competitive video game designed to get kids moving. Hope Labs VP and Communications Director Richard Tate says it's a pretty simple concept. Equip kids with a movement monitor, which they plug into their computer at the end of the day, and compete against other kids on how much they move that day. And there are rewards for each kid based on their level of activity.
The Zamzi website uses sound principles of motivational science to get kids moving more. It combines both extrinsic rewards, small prizes that get kids up off the couch, and the experience online is built in with a number of intrinsic rewards features, like positive game-like experiences where they experience success and feel competence and mastery for moving around. And that kind of positive experience keeps kids moving over time.
And as with their game Remission, when kids compete with a larger population, they're more inclined to want to succeed.
And there is a sense of discovery and excitement to see how many points you've earned for doing any number of activities, whether it's walking the dog, walking to school, even doing chores, or just running around with friends. And so digital experiences that are game-based have this element of surprise. You see how many points you're racking up over time. And then with Zamzi, those points actually power your online experience. And points allow you to move up the leaderboard. It allows you to compare and compete with others on the site. And it actually can help earn you rewards. If you're taking challenges, you can actually earn enough points for moving around that then get you small prizes that keep you engaged and keep you moving.
Hope Labs has been vigorously testing Zamzi, and the results are significant. Kids playing the Zamzi video game moved an average 60% more per day than kids in the control group that didn't have the game at their disposal. A simple movement monitor connected to a competitive video game that could motivate millions of kids to move more during the day, improving their health, well-being, and longevity. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the state of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia. He got his start in the private sector as an IT entrepreneur and is co-founder of several successful startups, including Electric Knowledge, which created one of the world's first natural language speaking search engines. Mr. Civic has also been a longtime promoter of code sharing and open source methods of expanding IT innovation. Brian, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
You know, your job at Health and Human Services is to harness the power of data, technology, and innovation to improve health and well-being of our nation. And you took over from Todd Park, who we like to say Todd's middle name is Liberate Data, who initiated that role. And you're monitoring everything from healthcare options for millions of Americans, from keeping food safe to infectious disease outbreaks at bay. The health data management volume seems to be pretty staggering. So tell us a little bit about the programs like healthdata.gov, as well as the Health Data Warehouse, and how they're helping HHS shift to a more open and transparent government.
Sure. Basically, one of the things that we frequently look at is the fact that one of the most amazing assets that we have here at the Department of Health and Human Services is really the vast quantity of data that our agencies create and maintain. And, you know, it's been realized for a while now that this asset really needs to be leveraged to a greater extent. And so, as you know, you mentioned a few years ago, my predecessor, Todd Park, came in and really started focusing on getting this information out to the public, to the entities that could actually take advantage of this, entrepreneurs, insurance companies, providers, you know, anyone in the system, actually consumers. I mean, anybody who touches the healthcare system at all can use this information. We, over the last few years, have undertaken a fairly significant program to liberate this data, which really means changing the default setting inside HHS from one of sort of protection of this asset to one of release of this asset. And we've done a great job, I think, to this point of really changing that default, getting people to realize that data is valuable, that it should be open by default with obvious protections in place for, you know, making sure that we don't release personally identifiable information. The, I would say, most recent manifestation of this is the healthdata.gov website, which is sort of the second version of our data warehouse. And we're building this actually all on open source technology. We, in the next couple of weeks, will be releasing our code base to the public on GitHub so that anybody can use this for themselves, contribute code, you know, improve the system itself. But internally, the whole idea is that we're making a system that should be easy for people to interact with in order to upload their data sets or the metadata about those data sets so that we can make it available to just about anybody out there.
Brian, you've said that in the past you had a ton of fun during your early days as an IT entrepreneur, certainly hoping that perspective stays with you. But much of what spawned that early innovation was collaboration with peers on how to build these better platforms for data sharing. Now you've shifted your skills to the public sector and you have an opportunity to help government help innovators, which you've euphemistically called an interesting challenge. So tell us about these unique and interesting challenges that you face in bringing public entities and bringing government into this 21st century exciting world of data sharing and IT innovation.
So the first thing I'll say is you should always beware when a geek calls a problem interesting, because that's usually code for very, very difficult. But, you know, I started my career at a college basically writing code for a startup that I co-founded. And I'm a tech entrepreneur at heart, and I'll kind of always self-identify as one. But one of the things that, you know, I think I realized in this role, or in that world, I should say, is that success is really all about being able to accept risk and learn from mistakes. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges in the public sector is just the willingness to take on risk and the incentives that drive the ability to take on risk. If you think about the idea of innovation, either in technology or in any sense, it requires experimentation. And so I think if we want to innovate in the public sector, we need to learn how to take some chances. You know, if I look across the now three different jobs that I've had in government at all different levels of government, really in order to innovate, we need to take some of these chances. And my job is really to help people assume this risk. The other thing I would say is that, you know, governments in general are sort of large, somewhat ossified entities that have very established silos and walls between various programs and entities. And there's a huge amount of value that's trapped up in those silos.
You've also been engaged, maybe in Maryland, when you launched the program called Civic Commons, which inspired by an attempt to get more interconnectivity between the states and the governments. It seems to me it's sort of a virtual back end for states, if you will. Can you tell us more about how Civic Commons initiative works and sort of the policy behind it and what's the funding mechanism moving forward?
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing I'll say is that was an idea we hatched back in D.C. With Code for America, not just within organizations, but cross jurisdictions. People are working on pretty much the same thing over and over and over again. So if you look at, you know, cities, almost every city has to have a certain set of infrastructure that they need to create in order to operate that city effectively. And we end up not doing a good job of sharing some of those things. And you see this repeated over and over again as you go up the jurisdiction jurisdictional ladder. And so really what Civic Commons was, it's an attempt to provide a relatively frictionless platform for sharing not just code or applications, but also ideas or policies or funding methodologies or what have you, in order to reduce the initial cost of development, reduce the cost of maintenance going forward, spread good ideas. That was the intention behind it.
Brian, it seems, as we look back, the Obama administration made a pledge, and I think substantially has kept it, to continue to work on making government more open and more transparent. And one of the initiatives in keeping with this goal is a partnership between Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine to launch the Community Health Data Initiative, making the data more available to innovators and entrepreneurs, with a goal that would then, of course, spur the development of new technology applications. HHS recently participated in the Health Data Palooza Forum in Washington, D.C. Tell us about some promising innovations that are growing out of those efforts that were unveiled there.
Sure. So the Data Palooza, as we affectionately call it here, is it was actually the third iteration of this event, which started roughly 2.5 or 3 years ago. And I think it's pretty amazing when you look at the path that it's taken. It started, like I said, a couple of years ago with 40 people sitting in a room in a pile of data. And a challenge to come back 90 days later with some interesting applications. It turned out that, 90 days later, over 2 dozen people showed up, or 2 dozen different applications were presented that, showed us the potential for utilizing this data that we have. And it's grown ever since. The second iteration was somewhere around 600 people. The Data Palooza 3 that was just held at the Washington Convention Center in June of this year had 1,600 people. There were over 200 apps that applied to present. I mean, it's really been quite phenomenal.
Huh.
A couple of good examples that have come out of this. There's a company called iTriage that we talk about a lot. This is a entity that was started by an ER doc, basically trying to use mobile applications to diagnose individuals mm-hmm. based on certain symptoms that they were presenting. And then they leverage some of our data in order to help drive people to the right provider at the right time based on the diagnosis of those symptoms. They were actually bought by Aetna recently. They've got 80 people. They're growing. They're doing really well. And so that's a great example. Another good example is a company called Humetrics, which for those folks out there who've heard of this thing called Blue Button, basically there's this technology that we've been working on in conjunction with the Veterans Administration for the last couple of years, which allows people to click a little blue button on a website and get their personal health record. This version of it doesn't have any specific structure associated with it. And so what Humetrics did was created an application called iBlueButton, which essentially takes this download of personal health data and translates it into a visual representation that's useful for the patient and for the doctor and for whoever else needs to see it. So that's another great example of an entity that has come out on this.
We're speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the State of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia. He got a start in the private sector as an IT entrepreneur and self-described tech geek, and is co-founder of several successful tech startups. Let's talk a little bit about innovation, and it seems to be central to the new paradigm at HHS. And in fact, the department just announced its fifth round of winners in the HHS Innovates program, which is intended to facilitate the exchange of innovative ideas that will enhance health and well-being for Americans. And so for the first time, you had a People's Choice winner and allowed the public to vote on this. So can you share with us some of the more exciting innovations that came out of this program, and also how much participation did you get from the public on this?
Sure. So, as you said, this round we had the first iteration of the People's Choice Awards, which was pretty exciting. We let the world basically vote on the finalists.
By Twitter, or how did they vote?
No, they voted on the internet.
On the internet.
Yeah, we had a web page up on our site. But Twitter's a good idea. Maybe we'll do that next time. We actually had remarkable participation. It was kind of cool. Tens of thousands of votes were cast. And, it was actually kind of fun to watch the finalists publicize to their user bases that we were doing this and try to get people to vote for it. So it was really, it got a lot of people really involved, which was fantastic. One of the winners, actually, of this round, I think the story is pretty awesome. The National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases basically came out with this application they call Free Stuff. And it's a really simple idea, I think, but it's a very powerful idea. Basically, in the past, you'd have a bunch of stuff within the organization that people had bought over time that were either going to be replaced because they had, you know, they needed newer models or they didn't need anymore. And, you know, typically these things, whether it's like a piece of lab equipment or a piece of furniture, would go back into some warehouse in, you know, the middle of Maryland to sit there for a while until some, you know, government process actually took care of it. Nobody really knows how that works or what happened to it. These guys realized that, you know, just because I didn't need this centrifuge anymore, somebody else might be able to use it. And so they put together, essentially, think of it as Craigslist for, mm-hmm. you know, government equipment, that, you know, a website that internal employees can actually look at.
Is there actually a big room like Raiders on the Lost Ark at the end where they find the Holy Grail? Is that?
in my imagination, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I hope that somewhere on one of those dusty shelves is an ark covered with a cloth. You know? But this story to me is pretty cool because basically the idea for this came up literally when this employee of this agency was out for a run one day, you know, and it just sort of hit her while she was running that, hey, this is a great idea. She goes back to the office, recruits a couple of people, and in their spare time, they put it together. And, you know, a little while later, you know, now it's being nominated for the HHS Innovates program, and it wins, and it's great. So that's a great example. Mm-hmm. Another great example, I think, is the Center for Disease Control's Zombie Apocalypse story. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but basically, they used this marketing campaign of a zombie apocalypse for disaster readiness to kind of help people understand how to get ready for potential disasters and things like that. And it won because I think it was very unique and different for governments to start marketing from this perspective. But the coolest thing happened to me the other day. I was on an airplane back from San Francisco to D.C., you know, and I was sitting there the whole flight. Actually, we connected in Dallas. So I'm sitting there the whole flight working, putting my stuff away at the end. And the guy sitting next to me, he had seen me kind of working this whole time and asked me what I did. I told him my job. And he looked at me and says, I have one question. I said, what's that? He said, what are you guys doing about the zombie apocalypse?
Oh, really? That's great.
It blew my mind, right? Yeah. Because there's a random guy living in Texas, you know, kind of on this airplane who had heard about this stuff and, you know, knew some of what we had been doing, which probably wouldn't have gotten out there had we not done a program like HHS Innovate. So I think these things really have some very mm-hmm. significant effect.
Well, Brian, I have to tell you, the zombie apocalypse was a little bit like the Martian invasion in some communities
right.
where people did take it kind of seriously. But, you know, those are great ideas. One of the words that keeps coming up over and over in various manifestations is connect. Connectors, connecting, mm-hmm. connections. And this is sort of central to the work that you're doing, it seems, connecting such disparate data that is stored and managed by HHS. And when you go to your healthdata.gov website, as our listeners are probably doing, there's a nice visual there that links all these programs into a constellation: Medicare, Medicaid, the Center for Disease Control, FDA, and others. And anybody can access the site and find all kinds of significant health data on numerous topics. So the question to me is, who's using the site and who's mining the data? Is it public health officials, people working on community transformation, clinicians, app inventors? Are you able to glean some intelligence on who's using the data in the public?
Well, we're working on that. I mean, you know, we have a ton of anecdotal evidence that people across the spectrum are actually using healthdata.gov and accessing the data sets, doing interesting things with the information. But we are constantly working on engagement and trying to get other folks and different communities involved. In fact, one of the big efforts that we are undertaking right now is really one of kind of connecting different groups of people that aren't typically that don't typically think about health data or think about ways to do interesting things with health data, and kind of bringing them into the fold. So, you know, I think in the past you've really needed to be a subject matter expert to understand a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to make some of these pieces of information more accessible. We're going to try to reach out to developer communities, to entrepreneurs, to venture capitalists, to providers, to any doctor out there. I mean, all of these different communities that we want to get involved. We're going to try to broaden the tent a little bit and get more and more folks involved. The neat thing is that since we launched healthdata.gov, I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of visits on the site. We're constantly improving the functionality. We're absolutely open to feedback. I mean, one way that I would stress one thing is that this is sort of, I would slap a beta label on this in a lot of ways, because mm-hmm. we are constantly looking at different things that we can do to make it more usable and more functional. And we're going to be doing some stuff around that in the near future. So keep your eyes on it.
Is that part of the government's new digital strategy? I know it's focusing on three things: making content more accurate, available, and secure. And you've been promoting application programming interfaces, or APIs, which are tools for building software. Applications is an important part of that process. So tell us about these APIs and why they're so important in securing meaningful use of government health data.
Sure. So basically what an API does is it allows a developer to access content and data in a machine-readable, but more importantly, a predictable way. So they can make a functional call to a service and actually get a piece of data back that they expect in a certain format, and then they can do something with it because it's in a certain format. In the past, I think developers have had to resort to techniques called, for example, like screen scraping, where they literally try to, using a program, read what's on a screen. And that's obviously a very brittle way to do something, because if the format of the display changes, then we obviously have a challenge with, having to update the program. So, there's some great examples out there. I think one really quick one is an app called Healthline that was built basically using APIs that the National Library of Medicine puts out. And that's all about basically providing information to consumers, beneficiaries, about diseases and conditions and all kinds of stuff like that. And that's just one example. I mean, there mm-hmm. are plenty of other ones. And one of the components of the digital strategy is actually to API enable as much content and data as we possibly can to make this even easier for everybody.
We've been speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic continues the department's goal towards more open government and meaningful sharing of public health data so that we can harness the power of data, technology, and innovation to improve health and well-being of our nation. You can find out more about these innovation initiatives by going to healthdata.gov. Brian, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Mariano here with this tech report. The folks at MIT are at it again, cooking up an invention that could transform a commonly reviled experience in healthcare: the hypodermic needle. Using ultrasound waves, MIT engineers have found a way to enhance the permeability of skin to drugs, making transdermal drug delivery more efficient.
I've got you under my skin.
MIT chemical engineering grad student Carl Schollhammer is on the team that developed the ultrasound waves that are basically employed to remove the uppermost layer of skin painlessly and temporarily so that drugs can be easily absorbed. The reason hypodermic needles are needed is they have to permeate that outer layer of skin. Not so with this system.
Under the influence of the ultrasonic waves, these bubbles grow in size and eventually become unstable. At this point, they implode and the surrounding fluid rushes into that space, creating a jet of fluid which removes the top layer of the skin.
So they temporarily remove that topmost layer. A patch is then applied with whatever drug is needed: insulin, steroids, vaccines.
After pretreatment with our device, a patient can place a patch over the pretreated area with the necessary drug and receive the required dose of that drug.
And voila! The skin grows back after a couple of hours, according to Schollhammer, and the best part, no pain. The paper on the MIT ultrasound drug delivery system is in the Journal of Controlled Release. I'm Ariane O'Hare with this tech report.
You If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.